did Christianity borrow some narratives and believe some paganism? This is a very important subject because we are in the season for it now. And first of all, I'm going to go right from the very top and answer the question partially, because I want us to put Christmas and Easter out of the way. Yes, they are paganism. They are pagans from the pagan religions, and they did borrow from them. So let's get that out of the way. Last December, you had a presentation with that, so I'm not going to really go to cover that and duplicate. What I'm dealing with is the narratives. If someone should come and ask you, tell me, in the Bible it says Christ walked on water, but in the pagan narratives it also says that. And those pagan religions were before Christianity. So how do you explain that? That is what I'm going to dig into today. I have lots of information, so I hope, please bear with me, I really want to get through all of them. Because I believe as Christians, we should be able to defend our religion and the fact that Christianity, and I don't want to give away the climax nor the conclusion, but Christianity is exclusive and look, it's the only true religion. So we should be able to defend that. So this presentation covers the biblical narratives, Christ walking on water, feeding of the 5,000, the virgin birth, Christ raising the dead, etc. Were they borrowed from paganism? And as I said earlier, it's not about the Christmas and the Easter that we know already. Now, here's some questions, some very pertinent questions. How certain are you that Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the narratives of the Holy Bible are not a myth? How certain are you about that? Remember, we're going to have people at some point in your life who's going to challenge your faith and challenge your belief system as well. Is Christianity a religion that borrowed from the pagan practices of old, as many skeptics today are saying? Because go on the internet, it's all over. Go on YouTube, it's all over. We have to be able to defend that. How sure are you that your God is true and the others are false? Pagan religions, just like Christianity, have stories about their gods, yes, walking on water, raising the dead, born of a virgin, and that Messiah. Do you realize that in the time of Jesus Christ, in the time of his crucifixion, there were about 32 people who claimed to have been messiahs? 32. Just like they claim they're messiahs to their people. So are you prepared to defend that? If so, how? Maybe I don't need to do this. Maybe all of you are in a position to defend it, I hope. And this is just a kind of refresher. But it's a very difficult subject. Because years ago someone posed it to me, and I had to walk away in my little shell. I couldn't answer. So when you leave here today, I hope from this you'll be able to defend that. So how can you defend that when some of these religions came, and this is a crucial question, they came before Christianity. In fact, long before Christianity. What's the answer? Well, you read about Mithra and other gods who had much in common with Christianity. So if someone searching for Christ asks you, as a child of God, to explain why there are so many similarities, what are you going to do? Can you defend these biblical accounts? Of course you could defend Christmas, and that it was sun god Mithra's birthday, and that Christianity did not borrow this day as a compromise to try to convert pagans to Christianity. But what about the others? Who was the lender? Who was the borrower? Brethren, there are thousands of people who have rejected Christianity because they could not find answers to these questions. A lot of skeptics out there, a lot of the critics of Christianity have left. A lot of scholars have just turned a blind eye to Christianity because some of these questions They weren't able to get the answer they were seeking. Now, and this is not a new concept. During a period of time running roughly from 1890 to 1940, scholars often alleged that early Christianity had been heavily influenced by the movements in the Hellenistic world, largely as a result of a series of scholarly books and articles written in rebuttal, allegations of early Christianity's dependence on its Hellenistic environment began to appear much less frequently in the publications of Bible scholars and classic scholars. For example, you have the Institute Freedom of Religion, which looked at that question. So it's nothing new for us. So today, I'm going to... Yeah, I put those little things not to get you bored. You can laugh. And right, so today we're going to look at two perspectives, the historical and the biblical. Now, look at these carefully. Christian beliefs with pagan roots. As I mentioned earlier, you had a separate study about Christmas. I won't dwell on that too much. But Easter, we know, came from the Teutonic goddess of fertility, Easter. We know the Trinity was patterned of the triune nature of gods in the pagan religions. The immortality of the soul, we know it was heavily influenced by pagan philosophers as well. And that souls go to heaven at death, it's all common in the pagan religions. It's like a central theme in those pagan religions. Some common pagan beliefs. Now look at these again closely. You can see the pictures there over those gods related to this belief system here. Osiris is said to bring his believers. This is what the pagan believes. Pagan religions teach. Osiris is said to bring his believers eternal life in an Egyptian heaven, contemplating the unutterable, indescribable glory of God. I should have put that capital G with a comma G. People in many mystery religions believed in the eternal life. It's not only unique to Christianity. They had it too. With the good going to the Elysian fields, which is a kind of heaven, and the not so good going to Hades. Going to Hades, a kind of hell. So, you know, in the Bible, Hades is translated hell, but it's really the grave. Apollonius of Tyana, in the pagan religions, he raised a girl from death, just as how Jesus raised Jairus' daughter in Matthew 9:18, and we know with Lazarus as well. These are stories the pagan religions had. Every single one of them there, we have some tenet of them in Christianity. How do you explain that? The babe Mithra was wrapped in swaddling clothes, placed in a manger, and attended by shepherds. And three wise men came with gifts to give baby Mithra. You wonder if people walking the streets out there would pause and look back into these things and say, what am I doing here with this festival called Christmas? He was considered a great traveling teacher and master. That's Mithra. He had 12 companions. He'd call them disciples, and the companions. Mithra is look at this one. This is blasphemous. Mithra is omniscient. There's only one that has that title, and it's the Almighty, Yahweh. As he hears all, sees all, knows all, and none can deceive him. He was identified with both the lion of the tribe of Judah. Who is that? Jesus. Speak of Jesus Christ. Well, Mithra had it too. And the lamb. Who is the lamb of God? Christ again. They had it. They had them. His sacred day was Sunday, the Lord's day. It's unfortunate that in Revelation 1, when Peter got the vision on the Isle of Patmos, and he said he was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day, that the Sunday people grab it and use it to say, oh, this is Sunday worship. But you know what the news is about that? The concept of Lord's Day did not enter into the religious belief system until around the second century. So John, writing in the first century, had no concept about this Lord's Day. What he knew about was the day of the Lord. Just to show you, that was just a side comment there, to show you how they twisted that Lord's Day concept. His religion had a Eucharist, believe it or not. Mithra had a Eucharist and emphasized baptism. You see where we are going, brethren, with all of these terminology we use that we have in our Bible? Follow me closely. Greece had the cults of Demeter and Dionysus. Egypt originated Isis and Osiris and Ishtar as well. Palestine and Syria had Adonis. Asia Minor, Cybele, the mother goddess. So all of these religions here at the bottom, they had these commonalities in their belief system. It's amazing. Look at these other narratives similar to Christianity. Jesus walked on water, feeding of the 5,000, raising the dead, resurrected and ascended to heaven, died as savior of the world. Some early Christians were, I don't know if you believe this, it's strange. Some early Christians, it is said that they were naked when they were baptized. It's just a, might have been a cultural thing, or, but because it's not really biblical. But after immersion, they would put on a white clothing and a crown, symbolizing, you know, the gift that that God, that they, you know, a saint would get this crown of righteousness. But followers of Mithra, they were also baptized naked, and they put on white clothing and a crown. They did the same thing. At Pentecost, the followers of Jesus were recorded as speaking in tongues or known languages. At Trophonius and Delos, the pagan priestesses also spoke in strange language, in tongues. The prophets of Baal, we know from studies, extra-biblical studies, they also spoke in tongues and strange languages. Now, here is a really significant practice in paganism. It's called the Taurobolium. What is the Taurobolium? It was a bloody rite associated with the worship of Mithra and of Attis, which is a bull which was slaughtered on a grating with a pit below, drenching the blood. You can see a picture here. And the bull drenching the blood. And guess what? It is believed widely that Christianity borrowed from this pagan practice in our Passover ritual. I'm going to come back to that later on, but I just want to go to this gentleman because he has had very significant influence in the paganism and Christianity connection. If you recall, he had this book called The Pagan Christ, which was a bestseller in Canada for many, many, many months. Even internationally, I think it was on the New York Times bestseller list. But in this book, and he's a former Anglican minister, he believes that originally there was one primal central myth which emerged undoubtedly in Egypt, and all the other sacred stories flow from there, including Christianity. This is a former Anglican minister. That is what he believed. In other words, Egypt was where it was all, where it was. Every other Christian practices and sacred stories came out of Egypt. He said the name of Jesus was derived from the Egyptian Lusa, which means the coming divine son who heals or saves. Egyptian. And that the god Horus, an Egyptian Christos or Christ, that he and his mother Isis were forerunners of the Christian Madonna and Child. And together they constituted a leading image in Egyptian religion for millennia prior to the Gospels. Now let me pause.
this here, I believe is true.
Because when you look at Catholicism, and you look like some of the other practices that came, this Madonna and child concept, there's no doubt. Horus, he said, had a virgin birth. And in one of his roles, he was a fisher of men with 12 followers. Now, this is what Harper is saying. All of these here were originally Egyptian ideas. Christianity pulled from them. That's what he's saying. He says the letters KRST appear on Egyptian mummy coffins many centuries BCE. And that this word, when the words are filled in, is really Karast or Christ, signifying Christ. So the very name Christ, he says, came from Egypt. The doctrine of the incarnation is in fact, he says, the most universal, oh boy. He says it's a myth, mythos. Known to religion, it was current in the Assyrian, I don't know what, let me just read it for you. It was current in the Assyrian religion in Egypt and at least 4,000 years, for 4,000 years. Now these fellows, they set out to rebuff Mr. Harper's pagan Christ after they did a review, and these are theologians. A very eminent one, Professor Kenneth Kitchen, University of Waterloo, he says, nothing by Higgins, but you know, they're going to rebuff this thing by Harper. But Harper's book was very popular, let me tell you that. A lot of people read that book. And a lot of people believed him because, you know, there's a concept in our society that anything seems to be against Christianity, people grab after it. And they will believe it too. It's like they just want to see an excuse just to ridicule Christianity. That's the temperament and that's the kind of attitude we have in our society today. They don't too much into other religion, but once Christianity is being attacked, they join the bandwagon, basically. But here's what he says. He said nothing, and in his book, The Pagan Christ, Harper quoted a fellow by the name of Higgins, a very widely read man. He did a lot of quotations on him to justify, you know, some of the belief system that he advocates in the book. He says nothing by Higgins could be of any value whatsoever because decipherment of the Egyptian hieroglyphs was still being finalized and very few texts were translated, and certainly not the vast mass of first-hand religious data. So he said, he just dismissed Harper and said, come on, this is, you can't use, it was a scholarly, some of the conclusions that he arrived at. Another scholar said, Egyptology, which Harper leaned on, has the unenviable distinction of being one of those disciplines that almost anyone can claim to, and the unfortunate distinction of being probably the most beleaguered by false prophets. So he dismissed the work as, which I agree, fringe nonsense. That's what he called this work. Now, it's serious what the statement Harper made about KRST, when you fill in the vowel, it's cursed and that it comes from this pagan god. So let's look at these commentaries on the etymologies for Jesus and Christ. Peter F. Dorman of the University of Chicago, he said, it is often tempting to suggest simplistic etymologies between Egyptian and Greek, or even other languages. But similar sequences of consonants and vowels are insufficient to demonstrate any convincing connection. Another professor here from the University of Toronto, Ron Lefrohan, he says, while Sa means son in Egypt, in ancient Egyptian, and Ayu means to come, Kun and Harper have the syntax all wrong. In any event, the name Lusa simple does not exist in Egyptian. That's why, you know, we have to check up on our facts, because you can't just take one side of the story. Because here Harper is leaning heavily that the term Lusa in Egyptian has a connection with Christ. But he says in Egyptian, the term does not exist. He says the name Jesus is Greek, and we know that, derived from a universally recognized Semitic name, Yeshua, or Jeshua, borne by many people in the first century. And while all the scholars agree that the image of the baby Horus and Isis has influenced the Christian iconography of Madonna and Child, as I said earlier, this is where the similarity stops. You see, the Catholic religion makes it bad too, because they borrow so much in their rituals, you know. So it gives the impression that, yes, you know, Christianity is just really a pagan religion. So the image of Mary and Jesus is not one of the earliest Christian images, which is true. It was not one of the earliest. And at any rate, there's no evidence for the idea that Horus was virgin birth. Again, another false allegation by Harper. He said there's no evidence for the idea that Horus was a fisher of men, or that his followers, the king's officials, were ever 12 in number. So I don't know where Mr. Harper get all this. He said KRST is the word for burial, coffin is written KRSW, but there's no evidence whatsoever to link this with the Greek title Christos, or Hebrew Mashiach. And for those of you, I can send you a copy of this if you want, but with one warning, one very stringent warning. These pictures that I use are copyrighted, so you can't give it to anybody else. It's just for your own personal use. My name is not written on it, so people sue you if you do it personally, right? But then they're copyrighted pictures, so you can use it for your personal use. But please, if you can give it to somebody, but not in any mass email where you say, no, put it on YouTube or anything like that. Okay. So, in summary, the Pagan Christ, as I say, I'm using this because a very influential book when it comes to paganism and Christianity. One critic sums up, he says, Harper book is based on the work of self-appointed scholars who seek to excavate literary and archaeological resources of the ancient world the way a crossword puzzle enthusiast mines dictionaries and lists of words, rather than by primary scholarship. So that's the conclusion. So I think it's important that we did touch on that. Buddhism. This religion, some people say it's not a religion, it's a movement, because there's no deity as in other religions, but this is gaining millions of followers, especially when you go to California and the entertainment industry. A lot of top names are going into this religion. And here's why too. There's a book called The Buddhist Christ, where many people are claiming that Jesus was Buddhist. Jesus was Buddhist. And yes, some of the books are there. Jesus Buddha, the original Jesus, the seed of Christ, Buddha within you, going home, Buddha and Jesus. Here's a fact that you don't overlook. That when Jesus walked the earth, Buddhism was more than was 500 years old. So 500 years before Christ walked the earth, this religion was there. Who was the borrower? Right. Historical accounts aside, many textual analyses indicate striking similarities between what was said by Jesus and by Buddha, and between the prophetic legend of Jesus and the ancient Buddhist text. Now, this would look very serious because Buddhism was before Christianity. So how come they're similar? This book here, if you have some time, if you read these books, I tell you, you have to be very strong in the faith, because they have some convincing arguments. I've read excerpts of some of them, and I tell you, you have to be firm and know what you're getting into. The trial of Jesus and his death on the cross. Buddhist sources of gospel narratives. I just put that there. I think you should get enough information from this to make a decision when you read that book. So did Christianity borrow? Or it was paganism that borrowed? We're going to see that. Explanations. So we're going to go into some explanations as we go along here now. Not because, and these are not necessarily my opinions, they're from a scholarly perspective as well, theologians as well, philosophers as well. Not because two things have similarities mean one borrowed from the other. And we can use some examples. I mean, we are human beings. There are some commonalities. I could go to a country and I discover a dish that probably tastes like something in my culture. But it doesn't mean that they borrowed from my culture. It's just that it happens that we eat the same food. Maybe prepare it similarly too. We all of us use fire to cook, so, and certain spices we use as well. So similarities may just be like that. And let me give you one example. Anyone here ever heard of Hammurabi? King Hammurabi? Okay. He lived before Moses. 300 plus years before Moses. But guess what? In Hammurabi's kingdom, he had laws similar to the Ten Commandments. Where did he get it from? Remember now, he lived before Moses. The Ten Commandments were not codified yet. There was no Sinai giving up the Ten Commandments. But Hammurabi had some of those laws. Where did he get it from? So the it's called Hammurabi's Code of Laws. And the laws God gave to Moses have certain similarities. Hammurabi lived before Moses, but the big difference is, the big difference is now, the spiritual application of the law. In Hammurabi's code, there were just civil laws. It says you should not have another woman if you're married. But those laws were given from the perspective of protecting the state and problems that it would create when you have a man living with his wife and then have other women. It was not from a spiritual point of view, where God says it's wrong. It's adultery. So the conclusion is that look over there, the overview of the code. One half of the code deals with matters of contract. Other provisions set terms of transition. A third of the code addresses household issues, and many of the provisions deal with the issues relating to military service. Because he was a king, trying to consolidate his power all the time, he established these codes as part of his military military perception of things. In order to have a civil society that is governed by laws and so on, he established these codes. But when you look closely at them, and I did a separate study for this, when you look closely at these laws and compare it with Moses' law, we realize that there are no spiritual components to Hammurabi's code, just a set of civil rules governing how people live. In other words, in the Old Testament, if you commit adultery, you should be stoned to death. So there's a kind of spiritual command from the divine one, God says you shouldn't do it. So Hammurabi lacked, his code lacked that perspective. Here's another explanation about these pagan beliefs. Mithraism has roots in India dating to 1500 BC, and it has many similarities to Christianity. But here's a key point. Author David Ulansey says, like the other ancient mystery religions, such as the Eleusinian mysteries and the mysteries of Isis, the Mithraic cult maintained strict secrecy about its teachings and practices. And note I underline this, because this is going to be very key in how you understand what I'm trying to present. He says, they maintain strict secrecy about its teachings and practices, revealing them only to initiates. It's like what you call, anybody familiar with the secret societies that we have, like the Masonry and all? You don't know those society, what they do until you go in there. Mithraism was like that. Every practice was secret. You couldn't know until you get in there to know what was happening. So keep that thought in the back of your head, because we're coming back to it. Because the question is, if it was so secret, then how Christianity knew about them to borrow from them? So keep that thought. We're going to come back to it. Another popular theologian says this about Mithraism. He says, owing to the cult's secrecy, we possess almost no literary evidence about the beliefs of Mithraism. Because it was so secret, they didn't know. They could only assume that maybe they did this and maybe they believe in that and so on. The few texts that do refer to the cult come not from Mithraic devotees themselves, but rather from outsiders such as early church fathers who mentioned Mithraism in order to attack it, and Platonic philosophers who attempted to find support in Mithraic symbolism for their own philosophical ideas. So it was really, really very secret. Here's another explanation again. Many theologians agree that because of the lack of textual evidence for early Mithraism, it is difficult to positively affirm that the teachings that appear to correspond to Christianity were being taught before the 2nd century A.D. I put the 2nd century A.D. in red. Again, this is very significant. I'll come back to it later, but let me just, I don't want to forget the thought. Because when you're processing so much information, sometimes you tend to forget. The 2nd century, we start to see some very interesting developments in Christianity. Why? After Polycarp died, 150 AD, which we regard as the last living apostle, and we went into the second towards the 3rd century, we see Christianity drifting away from what the early church taught. The early Hebraic roots of the church started to drift. The first 100 years of the church, we know that after the temple fell, there were some challenges and so on. But the church that re-emerged in 135 AD was very much different from the church that was when at 70 AD, that when Jerusalem was destroyed by the fire. We saw the drift away from Sabbath, away from the holy days and so on. And we see some very interesting beliefs entering the church. So that's why I put that in a second. But this trend changed by the 3rd century under Roman rule, when Mithraism became more open. Now this is what was going on now. This is how it got very interesting, because Mithraism, after it came under Roman rule, when Rome was expanding its tentacles all over the place, it was a royal ruling empire. So Mithraism, the secrecy that was surrounding Mithraism started to shed, and it became more open to adopt some Christian practices, and hear this, to gain adherence. So they wanted people to come in their religion, so they started to adopt some Christian practices. Not the other way around as yet, because Christianity in the later years, towards the mid 3rd century, they too started to borrow from paganism. The Christmas study proved that in 326 AD the Roman pontiff, by order of the emperor Constantine, had the first Christmas around 326. So although Mithraism was borrowing, Christianity was borrowing in too, but just with the Christmas was a big thing there, because there were three birthdays coming together with Saturnalia, the big for the god Saturn, agricultural harvest festival. Then you have the Invictus, Sol Invictus, Roman holiday as well, and then you also have Mithra's birthday. So it's three coming into one. So noteworthy is that the New Testament texts were already widely in circulation, although the Bible was not yet canonized. That is why, you know, you open your Bible and you don't see anything about Christmas celebration. Because by the time Christmas was accepted by the Romans and the Catholic Church, the Bible was already written, but it was not canonized. All the letters were there written already. So that's a very key point. Ronald Nash, a historian, he says, Allegations of an early Christian dependence on Mithraism have been rejected on many grounds. Mithraism had no concept of the death and resurrection of its God, and no place for any concept of a rebirth, at least during the early stages. And again, I underline, at least during the early stages, because this was when it was secret. They didn't have those in their secret. As far as historically we can see, they didn't have those concept about rebirth and death and all of that. They started borrowing it later to get adherents, to get people to come to their faith. During the early stages of the cult, the notion of rebirth would have been foreign to its basic outlook. Moreover, Mithraism was basically a military cult. Therefore, one must be skeptical about suggestions that it appealed to non-military people like the early Christians. Very strong argument there. Now, I come back to the Tarabolium. Remember that one with the heifer and the bleed and they catch the blood? That was their kind of Passover. The Tarabolium has been suggested as the basis of the Christian's redemption by blood, and Paul's imagery in Romans 6 of the believer's death and resurrection. Gunther Wagner, in an exclusive study called Pauline Baptism and the Pagan Mysteries, points out how anachronistic such comparisons are. In other words, the age in which they were portrayed doesn't correspond. The Tarabolium in the Attis cult is first attested in the time of Antoninus Pius for about 1 AD 160. As far as we can see at present, it only became a personal consecration at the beginning of the 3rd century. Again, keep your eye on the 2nd and 3rd century. By 160 AD, the Christian church was more or less still, I would say, not so polluted, because they were still keeping Sabbath and holy days, believe it or not. They weren't into Easter or Christmas or hell, going to hell or going to heaven, and so on. They were still, there was some a semblance of the original beliefs of the early church. But the 3rd century, from 200 upward, believe me, has some very drastic changes. So the idea of a rebirth through the instrumentality of the Tarabolium only emerges in isolated instances towards the end of the 4th century. Going further now, it is not originally associated with this bloodbath, we see. And indeed, there is inscriptional evidence from the 4th century AD that far from influencing Christianity, those who used the Tarabolium were influenced by Christians. It was the other way around. Not that we borrowed from them. They were borrowing from us. Why? They want to get more people. It was no longer secret, and they want to get more people in their religion. The virgin birth, another narrative. Again, the evidence showed that early Mithraism had no virgin birth. The early one, remember that, the early one, the secret one, had no virgin birth. Norman Geisler summarizes this by saying, "We do know that Mithraism, like its mystery competitors, had a basic myth. Mithra was supposedly born when he emerged from a rock." Well, this is what they believe, that Mithra was born when he emerged from a rock. This is what in the secret belief system that they had. No virgin birth. He was born from a rock. He was carrying a knife and torch and wearing a Phrygian cap. He battled first with the sun and then the primeval bull, which then became the ground of life for the human race. That is in the original belief. No virgin birth. New Testament scholars Ed Comaszewski and James Sawyer and Dan Wallace examined the falseness of these arguments. He said, the first is the composite facility, and this is how people interpret things. He said, critics group together pagan religions as if they were one when they compare them to Christianity. You know, so all pagan religion is just one. But there are different facets, as I mentioned earlier about Palestine have their own different one and so on. Egypt have their own different one. He said that's the first mistake, because they're not one. They're scattered and they have different systems, although they do have some commonalities, which they felt would show the obvious parallels. But when the individual myths themselves are studied, major differences became quite clear. And it also has another aspect, terminology fallacy. So the first one is composite, the next one is terminology. He says Christian terms are used to describe pagan beliefs, and this is very, very significant. And it thus consolidated that there are parallel origins and meanings. So I could come here this evening and tell you, oh, there was baptism in paganism. That's not the right use of the word, because there was no baptism in paganism. But I'm using Christian term to describe a practice that they did. But and it's different. It's not the same thing. So this is what he's saying here. Closer examination reveals this is not so, as the definitions differ significantly. For example, crosses, resurrection, virgin birth, they did not use those terms in early paganism. We use Christian terms to describe what they were doing, so people grab on and say, see, they're doing it just like us. So you look at the scholarly explanations for this and you say, oh, this is how it is. Another fallacy, he says, is chronology. And he says there's no archaeological evidence to support that there were mystery religions in Palestine in the first century AD. A very key point as well. Because, you know, Palestine, or I don't like the word Palestine, because, you know, it gets into politics when you use that. But in the Middle East, in the first century, he said there was no archaeological evidence to support that there were mystery religions there, around that area. Around that area, that's where the Christianity was born, you know. And archaeology is a very reliable science that you can get a lot of stuff. I've done a different study called Does Archaeology Prove the Bible, which I did separately. I have a lot of these PowerPoints, so from time to time on my trips here, I'll probably use some of them for you. Because I spend a lot of hours into these things. I have them at home and so on. But next, I'll be presenting this next month in Kentucky at a seminar down there, so still find use to them. He says, Jews and early Christians despised syncretism with other religions. This is true. The Jewish religion, and we talk about Judeo-Christian religion, of the early years, it's like the opposite of what is happening here now. They did not like to blend with other religions or have anything to do with other religions. They were like to themselves. It's not like nowadays you have people dipping into other religions and... No! The early church, the Jews, and the early Christians, they despise it. This is what the historical data says. They did not want to mix, so to speak. They abided by what they believed, their beliefs were. They were strictly monotheistic, one God. But the Greeks were polytheistic. They believed in more than one God. And with the influence of Greek society, at that time, it was hard for them not to adopt some of the Greek practices. The early Christians were very much against foreign beliefs. Ron Nash, another, the same author, he says, the uncompromising monotheism and the exclusiveness that the early church in the first century preached and practiced make the possibility of any pagan inroads unlikely, if not impossible. That's why I always harp back on the early church. I call it the primitive church, because when we talk about authentic religion, that's where we have to go. It's pure. They didn't mix. Nowadays we have all kind of different mixture going. You hear about Chrislam, we hear about... No. The early church, as historians tell you, they were very, very... They stuck to what they believed. They didn't dip into other stuff. Some important comparisons. Paul and the apostles, they look to the Old Testament. Teachings such as one God, blood atonement for sin, salvation by grace, sinfulness of mankind, and the resurrection have roots in Judaism. And they are completely foreign to Greek mythology. They didn't have all of those. Whereas, the concept of resurrection was not taught in any Greek mythological work prior to the late 2nd century AD. Again, always the 1st century, that period there is very critical. And that's why I spend a lot of time looking at the first 200 years of the church. Because I realize that is where, if you want to see true Christianity. When the church fathers came earlier, a lot of them pollute, believe me. No wonder Christianity today have so much high esteem for these church fathers. They match them almost on the level of the Bible. But there were a lot of they brought errors into the church, because by this time Greek society and paganism and the Roman society as well were like the demigods of the day, and they shape people's religion. They tell you, I mean, if you're not a Roman citizen, it's like you're nothing. So they force you to adopt Roman practices. None of the resurrections in these myths had the God of the universe dying a voluntary death. Another key factor. All these pagan gods, you would see, Jesus, we know, was the only one, whereas the deaths of other gods, these pagan gods, were due to hunting accidents, emasculation, and other calamities. So, they died, but they didn't die voluntarily. Some of them had accidents, some of them were even killed by some animal or whatever, and all of a sudden, oh, they're messiahs. Not a major difference. How did the pagan god die? They died by compulsion, not by choice. Sometimes they died in bitterness and despair rather than in self-giving God love. Jesus dies once and for all, Hebrews 7:27 and 9:25, while pagan gods repeat the death and rebirth cycle annually with the season. It was all tied to the season and sacrifices and so on. And here are some serious flaws with the pagan gods. One theologian says, the gods of the mysteries are incredibly human in nature and possess all that is most disturbing about us in our fallen state. They are petty at times, really petty. You send me 20,000 sacrifices of young boys this week. If I don't get it, I'm not going to send any rain. That's how petty they were. Intoxicated with lust and greed, which is true. And for power and control. At the same time, they are dreadfully inadequate and severely limited in authority. You study the Mayan religions, the number of young children who were sacrificed for those gods. They were always angry. When you read pagan theology, they're always angry. They won't send any rain, and when the thunder rolls, the gods are angry, and so on. So we know here's the difference, the only true and living God. The great God of all humanity is holy, just, and merciful. And he controls of all things, and his control of all things is contingent upon nothing but his sovereign will guided by pure love. Yahweh is self-existent, omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient. There was none before him, and there's none after him. He is the only creator who can offer grace to all humanity. Matt Slick, an author, says, at best, Mithraism only had some common themes with Christianity and Judaism, which were recorded in both the Old and New Testaments. What is far more probable is that Mithraism developed, it started to adopt Christian concepts. So they were the borrowers. Back to Buddhism. Many theologians agree that Buddhism is more a philosophical way of life or spiritual tradition than a religion. First of all, it does not believe in a deity and does not teach a relationship between humanity and God. That is central to Christianity, a relationship with God. Buddhism doesn't have that. Buddhism is really about this search for, and we hear that title so often nowadays, enlightenment. Enlightenment. I want to be enlightened. Through the practice and development of morality, meditation, and wisdom. However, compassion and a high regard for nature and life, they're important tenets. If you go to the Zen website on Buddhism, hear what they said. They said the similarities, meaning with Christianity, are so striking. Even if no historical evidence existed, we can suspect that Jesus studied Buddhist teachings, and that the prophecy and legend of Jesus was derived from Buddhist stories. This is what they have on their website, misleading people. And as I say, the gullible and those with the itching ears will go there and read and say, yes! See? Without even checking the evidence. That is what our society clings to when it comes to Christianity. They just want something to hold on to. But here's the explanation. Evidence from manuscripts shows that the original documents of the New Testament were written between 50 and 90 AD, the latest, maybe around 1995. Siddhartha, Gautama, the Buddha, he lived about 500 BC, but Buddha's teachings were not written down like what we have in the New Testament. They were given only by mouth. And brethren, when you talk about mouth, you know the danger with that. You tell, I can tell you one story in here now, and maybe by, say, 2 weeks' time, I come back and I ask each of you to tell me the story I tell you, and you're going to hear different versions. Everybody will have a different version. This is what happened in Buddhism. Was by mouth. In fact, Islam was the same thing too. By mouth. What happened after? It shouldn't come as a surprise, because the methods of preservation in those days. Here's the fact. Buddha's teaching became fragmented, distorted, and interpreted differently from the originally orally given one. So even with that, the original ones, it differ later on. A special council was convened in 3 BC by Moggaliputta Tissa to purify the Sangha, which is a community of monks in the Buddhist circles. It was discovered that a large number of false monks and heretics had joined the community or Sangha, but they were eventually rejected. The compilation of the Buddhist scriptures, Tipitaka, yes, was then reported to have been finished, but with changes. What the Sangha has now is a body of subtle philosophy to the doctrine. There's no evidence to prove Christ studied those teachings. The bottom line is he didn't need to. Why would our Savior Jesus Christ, the omniscient one, need Buddhist teachings? Why? He didn't need to, because he's the Son of God. He's God. And he's the source of all knowledge. So the conclusion on Buddhism, Christianity scriptures were written only about 30 to 70 years after the life of Christ by eyewitnesses. So to say that the teachings of Jesus were corrupted by a myriad of outside influences doesn't make sense. It is especially true when one takes into account the reports of Christ were recorded by eyewitnesses themselves, or people interviewed and wrote down eyewitnesses' testimony. Speeding up here a bit because I know I have a few little more things to deal with. The biblical position. What we glean from the Bible about this possibility of Christianity borrowing some of its narratives are from paganism. At the outset, we did indeed acknowledge some beliefs were borrowed, Christmas, Easter. What about the idea that the whole of Christianity borrowed? Question. Let's establish some facts. What or who was the first God known to humanity? So we are going now to the source. Who was the first God known to humanity? What was the first religious establishment? And the answer? The God of the Bible. Christianity came before Buddhism, Islam, and of course we know Judaism is rooted in Christianity. So all the major religions of the world goes back to the God Yahweh was before all of them. So no other religion existed before he gave instructions to Adam and Eve on the prescription of how to live. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And that's from Romans 1:20. Is there any other true God? Yahweh says, is there any God beside me? He said, no. There's no other rock. I know not one. And as I said, this is the original. This religion came before every other religion. Isaiah 45:5. I am the Lord. There is no other God apart from me. He said, there is no other one. So the God of the Bible declares he knows of no other God. He is self-existent, neither beginning of days or end of days. That was the God that made Adam and Eve and revealed himself to them. When they produced children, they learned about that God. There is a strong oral tradition as well. So the religions, because of the strong oral tradition, any religion could have borrowed what they were hearing. Because remember, God was only dealing with Israel. Their children's children learn about Yahweh. And that cycle of knowledge of the only true religion and the only true God continued from that time until this very day. So how can the Judeo-Christian religion, whose very foundation is from the only true God and religion, borrow from other mystery religions that came way after? Not because the Roman brand of Christianity did borrow some practices means the whole religion is tainted with paganism. If you note carefully, all the false religions develop a sacrificial system. All of them. Every single pagan religion developed a sacrificial system. Where did they get that from? The Judeo-Christian religion is the only one that had a sacrificial, originally had a sacrificial system. So then naturally they borrowed it. They were always sacrificed to these angry gods who could never be appeased. Yet our God, after the Old Testament system was abolished, sacrificial system, and Christ came, he sacrificed once and for all of us. So where did they get the idea of sacrifice from when the religion, original religion, practiced from the days of Cain and Abel? And later Israel had a more organized sacrificial system. It had to be from the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Oral traditions. Before there were written texts, how were these beliefs and practices passed on to succeeding generations? They were by the mouth. And words got around from culture to culture, from nation to nation, and from people to people. Remember, Abraham walked with God. He knew everything about God. He wanted him to know, yet we know of no written instructions. They were all given orally. Did Abraham need pagan mystery religions to know how to worship God? No. He got it from God himself. Far from it. He had it from the original one and the only source, Yahweh. Because of his obedience to God, God promised Abraham that he'd bless his seed. Only when Israel became the chosen people, we see written instructions. Very important as well. When Israel became the chosen people, that's when we see the written instructions. So from Moses onwards, the writings have existed. They were there for all to see, even copied as the mystery religions did. Because basically that's what they did, they copied. The architect behind that, of course, was Satan, who used to deceive the nations into believing that Christianity actually borrowed some of its teachings from the false religions or paganism. So conclusions. Did Christianity borrow its narratives and beliefs from paganism? Not entirely true. Yes, teachings such as Christmas, Easter, the Trinity, the immortality of the soul, going to heaven, do have roots in paganism. No one can deny that. But to say that when Jesus walked on water, he fed 5,000, the virgin birth, the resurrection were borrowed from paganism is not factual. It's the reverse. They borrowed. So many scholars now believe that it is Christianity's increasing popularity that caused a late form of Mithraism to change in order to sound more mainstream. So in summary, historically, most mystery religions were secretive in their beliefs, so they were not known. But when they came under outside influences such as the Roman and other empires, they began to adopt practices of other religions to gain a following. Christianity was no exception. On the other hand, Rome in turn borrowed some pagan practices to consolidate its power in Christianizing of the empire because of the religious aggressiveness, an example, Christmas, Easter, and Sunday. So coloring the evidence, this error occurs when a critic distorts the secretive teaching of the mystery religion by using Christian-type language to describe a belief. Remember that. When they talk about, paganism had virgin birth, baptism, resurrection, the pagans didn't use that term because they didn't know what it was. They are Christian terms, so don't let that confuse you. And then they claim that the Christianity stole from it because the beliefs are really similar. In reality, the mystery practice is usually something completely different in intent or symbolism than the Christian counterpart. And of course, Tara Bolium is one of them that I did describe. So did Christianity borrow or pagan religions borrow? This error happens quite often. It is usually assumed that because there is an element in an Eastern religion as well as in Christianity, the Christians must have borrowed from the Eastern tradition, since that religion's founder lived first. Christianity, we know, is always under attack. The problem is, primitive Christianity was so aggressive in its spread over the Roman Empire and Asia that many pagan religions adopted Christian symbols and practiced to make their religion look more appealing to halt the slide of converts to Christianity. Very important fact. The early church was so aggressive. Remember, these men were walking hundreds of miles. We drive to church, they were walking hundreds of miles without food, without any shelter. They have, you know, brethren had to put them up because they were on fire. That was the book of Acts says with the early church. They were on fire. They were so aggressive. And the pagan religions saw this and said, we have to do something too to get more adherence. So they borrowed some of those practices or some of those beliefs to look more appealing. So critics, again, they grouped together pagan religions as if they were one when they compare them to Christianity, which they felt would show the obvious parallels. But when the individual myths themselves are studied, major differences become quite clear. So the God of the mysteries are incredibly human in nature, and they possess all that is most disturbing about us in our fallen state. They are petty at times, intoxicated with lust, and greedy for power and control. At the same time, they are dreadfully inadequate and severely limited in authority. Teachings such as one God, blood atonement for sin, salvation by grace, sinfulness of mankind, and the resurrection are rooted in Judaism and are completely foreign to Greek mythology. The concept of resurrection was not taught in any Greek mythology work prior to the late 2nd century. So, biblically, the first religious belief system was started by Yahweh, the God of the Bible, with Adam and Eve, whom he gave instructions on how to live and obey him. Yahweh was and is the original. Any belief or worship system that comes after has to be a copy or a counterfeit. The oral tradition, the oracles given to the Jews, was very strong in biblical times. Thus, they were passed on to succeeding generations with care and meticulousness. Why would the Hebrew people and subsequently the primitive church borrow beliefs from pagan religions when they had their foundations in the original writings and beliefs? The uncompromising monotheism and the exclusiveness that the early church preached and practiced made the possibility of any pagan inroads unlikely, if not impossible. So where did the mixed religions learn about a sacrificial system when Cain and Abel were the ones to offer the first sacrifice? How could they talk about virgin birth and resurrection stories when those narratives were long embedded in the oral traditions of the Hebrew people? They copied. Only when Israel became the chosen people, we see the written instructions being given. From Moses onwards, the writings have existed. They were there for all to see and copied. And that's what the mystery religions did, under the authorship of Satan the devil, to deceive the nations. So did Christianity borrow its narrative from paganism? The answer, from the historical and the biblical facts, Christianity did not borrow its narratives. And the narratives I'm referring to, Christ walking on water, feeding the 5,000, etc. But what is borrowed were the major Christian festivals of today, Christmas and Easter, New Year's, Valentine's Day, and some elements of Halloween.